What's for dinner? What's for dinner? What's for dinner? Talking about what's ever on their minds. Talking about what's ever on their minds.
I told you.
Thank you, the T.I. app. Is that what that is? The T-Pain?
I think it was some T-Pain app.
That one, one of the T rappers.
You just put in what you wanted to say. And
I just put it, I kind of sang it, and then the app did that.
Made it sound good.
Songify, I think it is.
I don't think it was Songify.
No, it was before Songify. It was to make you auto-tune like the one rapper that always auto-tunes, which is all of them.
The one, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Precisely. Yeah, and so I'm like, oh, that sounds really cool. I'll use that. And then after a little while, it's almost become the joke of the show as opposed to something to be taken seriously. Thank you.
Yay!
Hey, guys. Welcome back to the studio / living room. This is our 94th episode. Did you know that, honey?
I did not.
This is 94. We're almost a Centaurian.
Centaur?
Power extreme. And very excited this week because not only have some amazing things been happening for Allison and myself, but we have a first time. This is so rare we get like a first time guest.
Oh, do you have repeats?
We have a lot of repeats because we have people that we like
neighbors.
We have fun with. We have
comic neighbors.
Last week we had Pat Melton, who lives like a minute away.
Right.
And Darren Carter is on a lot because he lives like two minutes away.
He lives close too, huh?
Yeah.
I like Darren a lot.
Oh, Darren's great.
Patrick I don't like so much. But
well, that's understandable. Yeah. It's Patrick.
I got to go do his podcast next. And I'm going to have to tell him that I don't like him.
He was telling us what you two talk about off the air a lot, too. I don't want to bring it up because it became a point of contention with Patrick last week. But our guest this week, first time to the show, Eddie Ift is here, everybody.
Yay.
Look at it. We just scared the cat. How you doing, man?
I'm okay. I'm just okay.
You're just okay?
Sometimes I'm good. You know, I'm not one of these people. I don't go into depressions or anything. But right now, I've got really nothing to be, like, super excited about. I'm floating along.
Merrily.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a happy guy in general. So,
good.
Like.
You are.
But I have nothing that I'm like, holy shit, I just booked a pilot. You know? I don't get any of those high highs anymore. Even if I did, I'd be like, I just booked a pilot. It probably won't get picked up.
I think we're about the same age. I'm not going to give a number, but I'm going to say you're
both about 28, right?
62.
65.
No, I'm between 62 and 20.
Okay. So, yeah, we're right in there. So probably the same year.
Yeah.
But no, I've kind of had that, like, I don't know what you would call it, whether it's an emotional epiphany or it's just I don't give a shit anymore.
Yeah,
I'm past
I gave up about 4 or 5 years ago where I just went. Because there were high highs and low lows,
mm-hmm.
and then the high highs started going away. So I went, I'm not going to care so that I can't have the low lows. And then it's just like I focus on all other aspects of my life. I focus on my surfing. I work out a lot. I got a good family life. And I just focus on that stuff. And that's where all my achievements and all my successes.
That's those are the more important
things.
That's
all the stuff in my life that I'm like, yay! And then my career, I'm like, oh yeah, it's now like I have a desk job, and I got to go to work every day. I'm like, I got to go do what I do.
So have you kind of lost the fire?
Oh, totally.
Really?
Because
what happened, man?
I guess I just got frustrated and just, you know, I think we all think we deserve more than we get, and I when I was very young in the business, very green, I was given a lot, and I probably wasn't ready for it.
Oh yeah.
And so it didn't go well. Like a lot of like shows I got and stuff got canceled or didn't get picked up or I got fired or whatever it was. So I like had my shot, but I had it way too early. And now that I'm ready for it, I'm not getting any shots. So I'm like, fuck you. Now I'm ready. Now I'm good. where'd all the shots go? And they're like, yeah, you had your chance. You know, you're only new once.
It's so weird that I had that same attitude for the long. Like, I got you can ask Allison. I got really bitter toward the business, toward this town, because I had the same thing happen to me. I moved out here in my mid-20s. I had, within 2 months, I had a huge manager, big agent, da-da-da-da-da. Then, over the next couple of years, nothing really popped. And I kind of felt I got pushed aside for the next crop of ones that came through and everything. But like I'm with you too. Like I kind of recently had this, like I said, emotional or whatever epiphany that none of this matters in the long run. I'm still surviving and getting by, still doing stand-up, maybe not in, you know, big shows in LA right now, but I'm still making my living doing it. I got a wife that I love. I'm healthy. I've got my family. You prioritize. And I find once you kind of do that and have really accepted that as not just something I'm going to try to do, but something that is, good shit is starting to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I can't complain. I was on a podcast the other day that it was Kenny Kane's podcast, all about the process of how we write our jokes, how we create and everything. And I said, you know, I know a lot of very, very, very successful comedians who are miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, with their lives, like that, because that's the only aspect of their life. Like, I really try to have a well-rounded life. And I have all aspects of my life. Like, I will blow off shit to go do stuff with my family. I will blow off gigs to go see my family in Pittsburgh. I will book gigs around Australia so that I can surf for 3 months straight.
That's so awesome.
I will, yeah.
That's,
you know,
your passion.
I make sure I go to, I make sure I write jokes for at least an hour every day. 1 hour every day I write jokes.
Oh, you actually set aside the
every
writing
day,
time.
1 hour at least, at the very least. I go to the gym at least an hour every day. So I'm like, if I can work on my body, I can work on my act. Like, I'm working on my health and I work on my act. So I've just tried to keep it. Now, in doing all this, I've probably become a lot less funny. When I was a fuck up, I was a lot funnier because my life was a disaster. But this, I've kind of just got my whole life in order and just tried to figure it all out and just gone, how do I tweak this? How do I tweak this? Now, but ultimately, would I like more career success? Yeah, that, you know, that would be.
Just
be
cool. Align yourself that is coming, that's, you know, where if you start to believe that this is what you can attain now with all the stuff you're grateful for and all the good stuff you get to do, just like he said, it sort of just starts to fall into its own place.
I mean, I've thought that before and stuff like that, and that's why now I'm just work on my act, and it's the only thing I can control.
Well, let me ask you this now. Since you said your life is more, you're less of a fuck up and
yeah,
things are more, you know, clearer, do you find your writing style and your
yeah,
everything
it's
changing
with
to. That too.
It's had to. And what I've always noticed is that I have such a big ego. Like, I have a horrendous ego and I'm ultra competitive and all this stuff that it's kept me from really being funny. Like, really, truly being funny. Because all my jokes are about everyone else and everything else, and I just never let it be about me.
Oh, interesting.
Because I don't like to be made fun of. And I don't like to be the brunt of jokes. And if I see shit like my fan base is horrendous, you know, like when they just love to ridicule, and whenever they see something that they can go after me, they go after me, and then I'll just read the Facebook comments and I'm like, oh
you take it too personally.
Yeah, I take it all personally, and I have to really step away from it but I've realized that if you watch the greatest comedians, they have such a point of view.
Oh,
because
totally.
They just talk about themselves.
Themselves, yeah.
Yeah, it's just about them. It's not about what they observe or anything. It's just, and you know what? I've never gone to therapy in my life, but I feel like comedians get good by going to therapy because they probably just sit there and talk about themselves.
They bring out stuff they didn't even think to talk about.
Yeah.
That's totally on par with other people.
She's my therapist, so a lot of my material lately is just coming from talking to her going, oh, you're right, I do that, don't I? Oh, I do have a problem with that. And then I'm able to take that tension or whatever and funnel it toward material that pokes fun at me, but I can laugh along with them.
Yeah, because I was never introspective before. I was always moving. I was like dodging bullets. It was like I didn't want to look at me.
It was like Matrix.
Yeah, I was just like, I'll just figure out how to dupe the next girl. Or I'll, you know, I'll... I used to hook up with girls, and every time I'd be hooking up with a girl, all I'd think is tricked them again, you know? Like, how did I do this? You know, I don't deserve her.
Did you feel like you were trying to live a lifestyle that you were supposed to live because you were a comic?
No, it wasn't a comic, like, because I had a bit of charm with women before I got into comedy.
I could see
and
that.
And so comedy, I always said, set me back a bit.
Really?
Yeah, because before I was a comic, I was like, I had a different attitude. And when I became a comic, it was like I had to explain myself. And
you're like,
I,
don't worry, I'm a comic. That's why I do these things.
Well, I almost took a step down in life. And being a comic, I went from being financially successful to this guy doing open mics. And where I grew up is a very what do you do and what do your parents do kind of place.
Like blue collar kind of?
No.
Or, like, sorry, white collar?
Like, yeah, like a wealthier suburb of Pittsburgh. You know, not super rich. Like, when we live in L.A. and New York and everything where you see rich. But these were the doctors and lawyers of
Right.
And so for me to go into comedy was like, you're going to do what? And you're going to go to where? Why would you want to do that? So all my friends that were all, you know, graduates of Ivy League schools and went on to Wall Street and were kind of the people that they were running with.
And then you just kind of broke off from the
pack.
Yeah,
I was the guy that took the path of least resistance. The path of more resistance, probably. But they all kind of looked at me like, what do you do? Like, you don't get paid. You know, you're doing stand-up for you. You have to, you know, when I start, you have to bring 15 friends and they don't pay you. And why would you do this? And so it was kind of embarrassing. You know, I would go out with friends and they'd go, oh, you know, I work on Wall Street and, you know, Jerry plays for the Steelers and Eddie's trying to be a comedian. And it was just like, ugh. So I almost played down that I was a comedian. And
so when you'd meet the women, they'd say, hey, it's like, so what do you do? I'm like, I know somebody who plays on the Steelers.
Yeah, I'd be like, I just inherited a shitload of money and I just lie to them and figure out. You know, I don't know. I guess because I grew up in a household where this wasn't an option. This was never, nobody ever.
Well,
see, it's funny because we grew up in Florida where everybody's a grandma. They're like, oh, that's so cute. You're doing what?
You're doing your little skit? We're going to come see you
we'll
do
come
your
and
skit.
Support.
Oh, even my grandparents. I come from a very Catholic family. And my grandfather and grandmother used to tell me every day when they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm doing stand-up comedy. They're like, we're going to pray for you. like what are you? How are you going to live? And I was like, I'm going to get paid to do stand-up comedy. And they're like, but nobody does that. And I was like, yeah, people do. And they're like, no. And they're, oh, God, now we got to move you to the top of the prayer list.
How many did you have, like, brothers and sisters?
I had three older sisters and one younger brother. My oldest sister, weirdly, is a talent manager.
Oh, funny.
So it helped me to kind of get the family to understand what I was doing.
You could make a living doing it.
There is money in this. Look.
Yeah, but I mean, she's had a big struggle too. She's had her ups and downs. She's doing very well now, but really a hard fight, hard fight. And then my other sister is a securities attorney and is a partner in a major law firm, like one of, I think, the biggest in the country. So she's super successful. And then the other sister was an asset manager for a massive bank in New York. And then my brother runs my dad's company now.
Watch out for the ifs, everybody.
Yeah. So it was Black Sheep right here was you know, it was a little difficult.
I was going to ask, like, did your siblings kind of back you up, or they were like,
the one in particular was so supportive. One sister I lived with in New York, and she kind of took care of me and not just financially, but she would go to my gigs a lot. And when I'd have a bad gig and I'd be so depressed, she'd be like, no, like, that wasn't your fault. You know, you might have said the wrong thing there, but then you were right what you say. You know, and I'd be like, I stink. I need to quit the business. She'd be like, no, you're real. You know, and she would be I'd get the pep talks from her that I probably wouldn't be doing if it wasn't for her right now.
Oh, that's great. That.
Yeah, she was amazing.
Well, it's good that you had some kind of family support there then.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to do it alone.
I mean, my parents were kind of like, I always tell people, I go sitting my dad down to tell him I was going to do it. When I sat him down and was like, look, I'm a comedian. He was like, why couldn't you just be gay? Like, it was worse than having that talk with it coming out. Like, you know, where the dad doesn't want to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I don't mind if you've been Frenching guys, but if you're on stage.
My dad would probably.
My son tells airline jokes.
Yeah. That's really, it was, in fact, like, I was hiding it from him for a while. Like, I was doing it. And not telling anyone.
Like a heroin addict? You're like in the corner,
would,
like with a microphone wrapped
around
you. I would
sneak out every day. They'd say, where are you going? Because I was living at home. They're like, where are you going? I'm like, oh, just to meet friends. And then I'd go do stand-up. And because I was working at his office during the day, and I'd write my jokes in the office. And
how old were you at the time?
I was right out of college. Okay. And I'd be in the newspaper then that week, and it would say, you know, opening at the Funny Bone, Eddie Ift. And my dad has the same name, so people would call him and be like, you're doing stand-up comedy? My dad's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And they're like, you're in the paper. So my dad started to catch on and kind of be like, we need to have a talk. And and he was upset.
I found your stash of jokes, son.
Yeah.
I found the props, son.
He was really upset. He could not believe that I was doing that. It was a week before I told him. We were talking about a guy, and he goes, oh, yeah, I remember that guy, Chuck Wallander. Yeah, I remember him. I kind of was into drugs a lot, and he even used to go down to that Funny Bone place, and he was trying to be a comedian. And I was like, oh, God. And at the same time I was doing it, I was like, oh, I've got to – oh, how am I ever going to tell them?
See, that it's so weird hearing that because, like, I was raised in a family that, number one, supported from – like, first time I did comedy, I was 8 years old at a talent show.
Wow.
And from day one, my parents said, if that's what you want to do, do it, and we're behind you. And my parents are very gregarious, and they would come to support and everything. So,
oh, they're just like Flip. If you meet them, you're like, oh, they should be doing stand-up too.
Oh, really? Really,
it's just a very, very fun Jewish family.
Yeah.
And just so here, I can't imagine that hiding it and being that so, like...
Don't get me wrong. My family's very, they're funny. My parents are both very funny, good storytellers.
But they didn't see the potential as far
didn't
as making
see
a
the
living.
Potential,
I guess, coming from Pittsburgh, it's not very common. And they didn't know anyone that had ever done it. And my dad and mom, you know, money's very important to them. You know, it's...
Yeah. Not with us, Jews. No Jews.
Yeah,
really
yeah.
Important.
Growing up in the community I did, you were kind of ranked by how much money you made. And that's how people look at people. And so it still has an effect on me.
I was going to say, it sounds like that's awful. That's kind of what had been affecting you up to the point now where you said you're having this more of a...
Yeah, it still bothers me because I feel like I've achieved a lot in the business, but I've never had that booming financial success. I mean, I've made a lot of money, but I haven't, you know, I'm not one of those guys that you go, holy shit, he's got five houses and blah, blah, blah. And weirdly, it's not important to me, but it is. It's not because I don't even, like, if I had all the money in the world, I'd probably live in the same house and I would drive the same car and I'm not one of those people. I don't need, in fact, I don't like a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I start getting, like people give me clothes now. I have like a clothing sponsor. They give me clothes and I don't want them because it's just too much shit.
Right.
Yeah. I like a very simple life. And so all the money in the world, I'd probably buy nicer things, but I still wouldn't have a lot of things.
Yeah.
Right.
I'd have one car. I don't want two cars. It's a pain in the ass.
They gotta store it.
Yeah.
Wash it.
I don't understand that concept. And I don't understand the concept of like a really expensive car that you can crash, unless you just can laugh at it. Like you fucking, I fucking destroyed that. Bring me another. I don't understand driving around. I had someone just recently take me out in their Bentley, and they're like, drive it. I'm like, I don't want to. And they're like, come on, you got to. It's a $250,000 car. And I'm like, I really don't want to drive it.
Now I'm nervous.
And it wasn't so much nerves as I didn't
just,
even
doesn't
I'd be
matter.
Nervous.
I don't give a shit.
I don't know how this is enjoyable.
Yeah.
I was driving. I'm like, yep, it's a car.
Yeah.
It goes.
I'm just thinking about if I ding it. At a $250,000
car. Well,
I thought
that too, and they let me know. They're like, "Don't worry about it. That's what insurance is for. I don't give a fuck if you flip it." That kind of. And but it didn't do anything for
me.
I'm
the same way. Like I drive my car as a PT Cruiser. I get
hot.
Shit
it's
from
hot.
Shut up.
Oh my god, they sell that the PT cock blocker.
It's
I didn't
blue.
Know when I bought it's it. It was kind
that
of a
you
gay
were the
car.
Only guy that bought one other than the rental car agencies.
I actually got it from an old rental car agency.
I'll bet you did.
I did.
Because they were the only ones that bought them.
And it's like a light blue sweet color as well.
Oh my god. It looks like a hearse for midgets and Teletubbies.
It is.
You know,
I have a joke on stage. Are we still going?
Yeah,
yes, no, we're still going.
You have a better chance of getting laid driving around in the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile with drenched in AIDS blood.
God, what a visual. Sorry, freak out. I just dropped my brand new Macintosh, but it seems to be working.
Did you just call it a Macintosh by
See,
its proper
that
name?
I like. What you have right there is way more important to me than a car. Like, I want the best, most efficient computer there is. Because I spend a lot more time on that than I do my car.
Driving in a car, yeah.
So I want one that is fast, that all the speed, blah, blah, blah. That's the kind of thing I care about.
And, see, and what I was saying, too, is the same thing. Like, I have this piece of the PT Cruiser and blah, blah, funny, whatever. But it's paid off. It works. It gets me where I need to go. So I don't want a Bentley. I might upgrade to a nice fucking Ford or something.
Here's what I think we're all getting to. And that is, and I've had this talk a million times, especially when I lived in England, that it's the problem with America. Is that America, and I have fallen victim to it, is that most people in America, I think, because of capitalism, value money more than anything.
It's, yeah.
And money is the number one sign of success.
Right.
Whereas, because we all know there's a bunch of comedians out there that are financially successful, like super, super financial, that no one respects, that we all think they suck, that they're not funny at all. Yet there are, on the other end of the spectrum, guys that are hysterical, that don't make any money, that are, they're the greatest comic ever. And, but weirdly, because it's America, the money ones get put on the pedestal of like, they're the shit. And we have a weird value system here, which fucks up our whole country.
Yep.
Like, I think capitalism has just ruined this country.
Oh,
just
absolutely.
Ruined it to the point of it's fucking going down. Like, people used to say to me, doesn't it piss you off that you're, you know, really successful in other countries and not America? And I was like, well, let's look at this. The number one restaurant in America is McDonald's. The number one form of entertainment is like is WWE. NASCAR is like the number one sport.
Because there's so much more middle part.
Our number one musician, Justin Bieber, is on number one on our chart. Like, we have no taste as Americans.
Right.
It's shit. It's shit. We like shit. We like branded shit.
We've been guided to like shit, though.
Yeah.
We've been truly guided.
Oh, yeah. We're kind of spoon-fed nothing but garbage as far as...
So then we just choose the best of the garbage.
Right. I mean, there are those who seek out other things, better things, but... But the stuff that's just thrown into our face ad nauseum is the shit.
Yeah, it's branded, and whatever brands well is what sells.
It's so, like, how long have you been in LA now?
About 9 years.
9 years. Okay, so, like, I'm not because I've been here about 13 now, but maybe around the time that you were getting here, like, there seemed to be this shift between going for talent and really developing it into this... finding someone new and young in the town, giving them all of this attention, see if it works after a year, if it doesn't, next.
Yeah.
Like, the entertainment business has really lost the patience, I think, as far as development now.
Of course, because now...
Because now, like you said, it's just branding.
Well,
it's
also, let's just see... who's picking up a following on their own. Like, they don't... What it used to be is they would have to pick who they thought was likable. Then they would have to put them on the air and hope that they are likable. Now what they do is go, let's go to YouTube and find out who all... And Twitter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And find these numbers that have calibrated if these people are likable. There's a reason people... You know, like, I'm not throwing them under the bus, but, like, Kevin Hart is extremely successful. He's got a massive following. People like Kevin Hart. So they go, let's just use Kevin Hart. People like him. It's all about this likability. Obviously, the numbers are there. It's proven. People are following him. They're going to his movies. They're watching his concerts. Then let's just keep using him because it works.
Right.
You know, it's like you're a football player. You're going to play in a game. What shoes are you going to wear? I'm going to wear the Nikes. I know they work. Everyone else is using them. They must work. They qualify. Let's wear those. I'm not going to take a chance on some fucking no-name shoe.
Right.
I don't know what it does or if it's going to fall apart.
Yeah,
or...
so it's almost like the social media has it saved them a step.
Yeah, it's saved. They don't have to do any work. I mean...
But that's also bullshit because... somebody could be popular for many different reasons, talent of which could be number 7 on the list, if there is even any.
Yeah.
Like, some people get notoriety. I'm not sure if I'm a little bit of a tangent, but I was doing a shoot the other day with these kids, and they showed me this video of a Sharquista. Have you seen this?
No.
Have you heard of this, honey? Sharquista? No. Sharquista? No. Basically, it's this Vine video or some YouTube video where these two black girls are like, you know, stepping off to each other, if as the kids say, and one of them just cold cocks the other one, just bam. But this, it was on the news. It's like the biggest social thing, and I'm not saying this as a joke, but it would not surprise me if some agent went, let's get her on the phone and nab her
just
up before
like
somebody
Antoine
else
Dodson.
Does.
No, they would for, I don't think they would do that, but if she put up a series of them that started to get like a million subscribers, they would. One off, they're not going to. But, you know, there's also so much in people buying Twitter followers and buying YouTube clicks and buying all this stuff that you never know what numbers are real. But it's just, I used to hear comics always talk about other comics' bits. Like, did you hear that joke? It's so funny. And guys would quote it and say it. No one says that anymore. They go, did you hear how many followers he got? Did you hear how much money he got? Did you hear he just sold out 4 shows in a row? Did you? I never hear, you know, that joke he does about blah, blah, blah.
Well, look what we're being shown every day of our lives. Wherever we look is just to, you know, pray to the almighty dollar. And that is so, okay, you've achieved your success because you have this amount of dollars. It's just like you say with Kim Kardashian. Why do we follow them? Because there's some rich family. And now everybody's starting to do that. Here's some rich family. You ever seen the rich kids in Beverly Hills? Rich, rich, rich. They're telling us that that's the only way that we need to be.
Well, there's a thing I learned in psychology class in college that they said that if you put an orange on television, the fruit, an orange on TV every day for an hour, just put it on TV.
People will want
it. And then after a month of it, roll it down the street, everybody's going to stop and go, look, there's that orange. And it's, you push something in people's faces enough, they're going to, you know, people ask me how I became successful in Australia. And I always say, I was the chosen one. I was the lucky guy that was put in front of a lot of people. Now, I had a certain level of talent that got me there, but there's a lot of guys with that level of talent. I was just the one that lucked out that got, like, the magic fairy wand that went, we're going to make you successful. And they just constantly put me on TV and put me, you know, there was money backing me in my promotions that made me have a successful career there. And no one's done that for me in the United States. But I've seen people that have had it happen, and you just go, yeah, obviously, they're going to get bigger and bigger and bigger because the magic – and people say, oh, you know, my one manager just said, be undeniably funny. And I said to him, you should have told me to be undeniably lucky because I've seen a lot of guys. He's like, yeah, I've seen a lot of lucky guys make it, but they never sustain it. The guy – on the way over here, I was talking to a friend. I said, there's a lot of lucky people in this business – or there's a lot of guys that work really hard and have made it by working on it. There's a lot of guys that are really talented and have made it. But the combination of hard work and talent pretty much assures it. Like, if you have both of those, like, you work really fucking hard. And mm-hmm. I mean hard, like 12 hours a day every day. And you're also, like, ridiculously talented. You'll end up like Chris Rock or
CK.
Or Louis, or one of those guys.
Yeah.
The guys that just have the talent, I've seen a lot of those. And they don't go half as far. And the guys that work really hard, I've seen them go really hard. There's a lot of them out there.
But
guys,
I think luck does have a little to do with it, too.
Yeah, there's a
because
lot.
Because I know guys that are very talented and that work hard, but either they never get the opportunity to move out to L.A. or New York, or they just...
I was go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I was going to say, I think luck can be created if you're really, like we were talking about before, if you're kind of just grateful for what you have, love all the things that you have, and then don't need but desire something, you know, a bigger, you know, move in your career or whatnot, you will, I believe that you can will these things to you and hence create more luck. Because I think that if you're just good and grateful.
Sure.
Sounds like religion.
But when luck, you know, it's, look, there's. Sometimes people want apples, sometimes people want oranges.
Like the one that rolled down the street.
Yes. And there's communities of people that people want. And you can fall into that community where you just happen to be in the right place at the right time. And I've seen a lot of people. A lot of people are just in the right place at the right time. Yeah. And so, you know, you need this perfect storm of shit to happen.
No, absolutely.
And it gets frustrating because you're around long enough. You're like, geez, can I just fucking be in a little storm? Like, when's it going to fucking swing my way?
What year did you start?
I started 18 years ago, 96, I think.
Okay, so
96.
Because I started in 92, and that's about a little over 21 years ago now. Holy shit.
Yeah.
I forgot the point I was going to make. You were talking about, sorry. You're talking about, just getting a little storm.
Like, yeah, but I mean, people tell me, they'll be like, you're an asshole. You've been on sitcoms, you've done this, you've done that. And I'll be like, yeah, but that's not what I want. Well, what did you want to do? You know, it's like, you know, we all want, I want fucking Louis's career. Like, well, you didn't work as hard and weren't as talented as Louis. You know, and that's what you just have to sometimes go, oh, that's why.
Well, I think like the worst thing you could do, and I did this a lot myself, is compare your career to somebody else's. Nobody is going to have the same exact career as a predecessor. No one's going to have the same opportunities that so-and-so had.
No, but sometimes you look around at guys that are, you know, like you started with, and you're like, they're all doing better than me. I mean, I remember when I did New Faces at Montreal, the entire class that went with me all are fucking, you know, on fire. And I'm like, did I do something wrong? Did I... You know, and I made some decisions that I go, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Like, I traveled the world at a young age in comedy. Like, I started going overseas before. I mean, I was one of the first guys I felt like there were only a crop of guys that would go over to, like, the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, guys like Vic Henley and Ross Noble, but there were like this group of guys, Rich Hall,
mm-hmm.
and I,
yeah, yeah.
Tom Rhodes, and I was like, I want to do that. And so I started doing it, and I was like, this is amazing. You know, I'm in England, and then I'm in South Africa, and then I'm in China.
Wow.
And I was going around the world performing in all these places. So I made a movie about it because I thought people need to know what I'm doing, especially in America. That there's a reason I'm not going to auditions anymore. There's a reason I don't go to pilot season because I'm around the world, you know, learning, becoming more worldly.
And a better comic.
And a better comic that I can go into any situation and do these shows. So, but it was like nobody gave a fuck. And then the movie, we finished the movie, but we never released it because some logistical things. But it was... You know, then when that didn't happen, the movie, you know, we were showing it to people at Sundance and they're like, this is genius. This is going to be a massive film. And then it didn't happen. I was like, oh my God, I've just made a really bad decision. I've spent all these years doing this when I should have just fucking gone and auditioned. And because what had happened is overseas, a lot of the guys that made it here in America came over and were bigger than me. Overseas just because of their name in America. And I'm like, if I had just stayed and just worked at getting a TV career in America, I could have come over and been bigger. Like, this was the fast track. I thought, you know, all this hard work I was putting in overseas was the way to go, but it was probably better to just stay in America. And
see, I think we all have those moments, like you look back and go, oh, if only I would have done this and this. But that still doesn't mean that it would have happened.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, you tell me the story, and I look at it this way, like, dude, you got to go to places that 95% of all the comedians in this country will never go to. And you got to experience it when you were young and had this energy,
yeah,
this vitality.
Gotten laid in towns I didn't know you could get laid in. I thought it was illegal. I think it was a lot of the places I was.
And the great thing too, and this is what gets me through the times when I'm like down on myself and going, what am I doing? Blah blah. It's never over.
Oh no, it's never over.
Never over. And that's why.
But it's rare. It's rare that you see. I said this the other day to someone. I was like, why am I even trying? You know, blah blah blah. And a buddy of mine, Jesse, who used to book the Improv, said,
I remember Jesse.
He goes, look at Lewis Black. Look how long it took him, and then he hit, and he was on fire, and now he's known as one of the best comedians. I go, yeah, but everyone talked about Lewis, how good he was up until then. I go, no one talks about someone till they hit. Once they hit, they all talk about them. Right. And it sucks because that's how we are as a public. They don't, you know, people are bandwagoners. They jump on the bandwagon and they want to talk about someone that's, because nobody wants that, take that risk of saying something's great and having people go, what are you talking about? You know, they want to say, well, look, he sold more albums than anyone else and he likes them and they like them. And they put him on this and they put him on that. It's very easy to – I had an agent tell me that once. She goes, you're not qualified. I go, what do you mean I'm not qualified? She goes, that's your problem. She goes, nobody's qualified you yet. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, you need like a friend or a relative to give you a job on a show, and then everyone else will give you a job. Because they'll go, oh, yeah, he was on that show. And she goes, you know, like Quentin Tarantino books you in a movie, everyone will put you in their movie. Because they – if they get in trouble for putting you in the film and somebody goes, why would you book him? They go, well, he was in Quentin Tarantino's film. And then it's like they're laying it off.
So it's but it's almost like a catch 22. It's
yeah,
like it's,
yeah, you have to somehow cheat and lie, cheat and steal. It's like how they say, you know, you got to steal, you know, you steal your first million to then make money. And you know, a lot of people that have made a lot of money stole their first chunk of money. And I know a lot of people that have done business.
Kennedy's,
like
Rothschilds.
Yeah. People they do really shitty stuff to make it, and then they go legit. I was saying it the other day with. It's a thing with steroids. You can take steroids, performance-enhancing drugs, get all this muscle mass, and then stop taking them. But your body knows that pathway now to get that muscle structure. So even though you're off the steroids, you still had that benefit of using them.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys are like, oh, I used them, you know, my first season, never used them again. Well,
it's still cheating.
And there's a lot of comics who made it really successful on drugs and alcohol, and it was like a performance-enhancing drug for them, and it lowers your inhibitions. If you're using alcohol, cocaine is going to make you confident, and you're going to be able to perform at this high rate and become successful. And once you're successful, you're still going to get booked on your name forever,
right?
And so you've established this,
but you cheated by having those
little things. Well, I mean, I don't call it cheating, I call it just living life and you know, whatever you want to do.
But. Were you a big partier in the day?
Yeah, I partied a lot. I used a lot. I mean, I drank a lot. Like, I never thought so, but I, in retrospect, I probably was an alcoholic. I drink so little now. Like, I drank last night, and it was so hard on me. I had 5 drinks, and I was a mess today.
Oh, Jesus, 5.
A mess.
I can't do it anymore.
No, me neither. But I look back at so much of my life was a blur. Like, just... I'd have 5 before I did my show.
Holy shit.
And then I'd have 2 on stage, and then a whole night of partying afterwards.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, till 4 or 5 in the morning, go sleep till 3 in the afternoon, and then do it again.
Yep.
And it was a big party. And that went for a long time. A long time.
So what was it that made you finally go, I got to fucking stop this?
I was living in New York, and I realized that all I did was go out all night long and sleep all day. And I went, I want to get healthier. So I moved out to L.A. and said, I'm going to wake up early. I'm going to take advantage of the fact that I'm out. Like, the stuff I really like in life. I'm a skier. I grew up skiing and surfing and stuff. So I'm like, I'm gonna get into surfing. I'm going to do the stuff I enjoy doing. I got back into working out again, and, you know, it was, I was eating well, and I couldn't drink like that. Like, last night killed me. I'm in pain right now.
Do you want some juice or
anything? No, I'm fine. My body can't handle it. Like, it used to be, I'd go to Australia for a month and drink from the minute I got there till the minute I left, and just be like, I feel great. You know, because
that's what the 20s are for.
I'd sleep off the hangover, 20s and 30s. You know, I'd sleep off the hangover and just go again. And just can't do it now.
I don't blame you. Like the last time I got really shit faced, I was in Sweden. Like, was it 2 years ago?
Something like that, yeah. Maybe.
And I remember I went out after show with some of the other comics, and there were people from the show at the bar we happened to be. Buying drinks, and I knew my limit at the time, and I remember these guys gave me this one shot, and I looked, it looked scary, you know, when it's like, it's when you could see the layers of alcohol sitting on top of each other. In my head, I'm like, yeah, this isn't a good idea, but fuck it, I'm on tour, I'm in Sweden, and I did it, and I just felt myself go past that line. And later that night, I was trying to FaceTime her it for my hotel room, and I saw myself. I was just like, I can't talk right now. And I had to go and make myself throw up. And I remember just seeing myself in the mirror, hugging the toilet, going, this isn't right. I can't do this anymore.
Awful. And I would do that, oh, God, once every couple weeks.
Oh.
See, whenever I have those nights, I say I'm not going to do it, and then give me, a few months. No, I'm kidding. I really don't drink that much. But when I do it, I never, swear myself off it, because I know I'm not going
to. No, you don't do it that often. You don't do it often enough to be worried. But when you do, boy, do you.
Yeah, I have so many stories about so many crazy nights that I go, I don't make those nights anymore. They don't happen. That's not going to happen anymore. What I would do, and I'm not proud of a lot of the shit I did, because there was a lot of bad things, a lot of drunk driving, a lot of sleeping with people I should, chicks that I would not proud of, and bad shit. But I was enjoying it, because at the time I was in party mode, and it gave me all my stories, and I thought that's what life was. I was to me, I was living the dream.
Is that what you thought? And that kind of goes back to your question I asked before. Did you do that because you thought that's what you should be doing as this comic, or because?
I grew up in a high school where everybody drank and partied. It was a big party high school. Crazy. Rich parents going out of town on the weekends, kids taking over the house and throwing a massive party. By the time I was 16, I had a fake ID. I was in bars at age 16.
Oh, wow.
Getting into bars. When I was a senior in high school, I would go down to the University of Pittsburgh campus where my sisters were going to school, and I would go to fraternity parties, sorority parties, and go to all the bars. And
at 16?
At 16. Or no, this was at about 17, 18 years old, when I was senior, about 18. And that was it. I was going off to college to continue my partying career. And when I got to college, it was all about that. I joined a fraternity, and it was, where's the party? How do we create the party? When's the next party? What are we going to drink at the party? What is the party? And when I got out of college, I didn't know what to do with myself. And I would start doing stand-up, but I was lost in Pittsburgh. And I would go out every night with my best friend, who was also kind of lost. And we would just go out and party every night in Pittsburgh. And then I got into stand-up, and it continued the party, because I was in a nightclub every night, and people were giving me free drinks. And I was like, this is great. I get to drink all the time for free, and there's girls around. And I think a lot of it had to do with girls. I can create this party and get these girls, and let's just make this shit happen. But in retrospect, it's probably a lot of lost time and a lost I probably fucked up some parts of my life. I wasn't missing jobs or that kind of stuff.
So it never interfered?
No. And I could quit at any second. I could just go, I don't want to drink anymore. Or days off, it just never, it wasn't an alcohol problem. But I look back and I'm like, I used a lot of alcohol, a fucking shitload. Because I always thought this will be fun, but alcohol will make it 10 times
better. Yeah. Were you one of those guys that needed the drink before you got on stage? It became part of a ritual?
No, I never did. And now, weirdly, I do feel like sometimes I'm like, you know what? If I have a, I think I was just thinking about this recently, that I always thought I was super gregarious and super friendly and blah, blah, blah. And I just loved to party and talk to everybody. And more I'm thinking either I've changed or I'm not. And I need to drink to be able to tolerate people or be in an environment. And the same goes with alcohol for my shows. If I have a couple drinks, I think I'm 1,000 times funnier. I go, oh, if I have a couple drinks, I'm going to let go of all my inhibitions. I'm going to be less aware of the audience.
Yeah.
I'm going to care less, which is going to make me be funnier. So there
did you ever tape yourself and watch yourself after having the drinks and then kind of objectively go, oh, alcohol doesn't make me funnier.
I just know that I'm more creative when I'm drinking because I'm more willing to say things that I wouldn't say.
Oh, I got you. So it's lowering
the
inhibitions.
Yeah, yeah. And so there are times when I kind of go, I don't do it a lot, but every once in a while I go, I need kind of a breakthrough on these bits. So tonight I'm going to have a few drinks and get on stage and let it go.
Wow.
And at the end of the show, I'm like, oh, yeah, I got 5 new jokes out of that. And it's almost like cheating.
Back to the performance
enhancements.
Yeah, exactly.
I used to live with Jim Jeffries, and we talked about that a lot, that we think our best shows were on alcohol, like really fucked up.
Well, Jim is still a big drinker.
He says he's not. I don't know him much anymore. We're not in touch, but I don't know if he's still.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know if he... he used to say he didn't, but he would still do it. Like, he was like, oh, I don't drink. And then I'd be like, wait, I just heard you were shit-faced licking some guy's neck, you know? And he's like,
so, all right, maybe I did have a drink or two.
Yeah, I know he battles with it, but mine isn't so much a battle. Mine is more like, let's, you know, it's like taking Viagra to get a boner. It's like, yeah, I'm going to take the alcohol and get some good jokes tonight. You know, I'll have 3 drinks and... You know, that we'll have that little breakthrough we need.
But now it happens less frequently.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'll go out for a week on the road, and there might be one night that I actually have some drinks. You know, I'm probably, if that, like one night a week drinking, if that. And usually it's 2 or 3 drinks.
Yeah.
I probably have about 3 drinks a week. That's about
Yeah, that's
average.
About my average, too, when I'm on the road. I prefer it.
Anywhere. Yeah,
this
like
week
home.
On AA, we're all like, when was your last drink? It was 3 nights ago.
It's weird because it used to be, I mean, I would drink beers in the shower, like getting ready to go to the party. You know, I grew up,
man.
Even in high school, it was like there's a football game or a soccer game. You get drunk, you go to the soccer game. There's a school dance. You get drunk, you go to the school dance. You drink, you know, out of flasks. You drink afterwards. It was just such a part of my culture, like my growing up.
Wow, that's, again, it's like a complete 180 of the way I grew up.
Really?
I was a good kid. I didn't drink. I have a beer. Oh, my God. It wasn't until I started doing comedy that I actually started drinking liquor and...
Yeah.
Really kind of getting, but even at my darkest, I wasn't anywhere like where what you were saying as far as your growing up.
Yeah. And I, in the beginning, the first 10 years of my career, a lot of my jokes are all about alcohol and drinking and partying and women and stuff.
Well,
you
write about where you are in your life.
Yeah, so yeah, yeah. And that's really hard because then you have to retire jokes. You have to.
Oh, no. Or
they just don't fit.
Into who you are now.
Yeah, it's terrible. I have all these great jokes that I'm like, can't use that. Can't use that.
Dude, I have hours of shit that I used to do that maybe wasn't about drinking, but it was just sillier stuff or just more earlier in my career, immature jokes. That's you look back at it and I'm going, God, did I ever need to do those jokes?
Yeah. And every once in a while I try to throw one in and you remember it killing. And then you go to do it and you're like, it didn't kill.
It didn't kill like I remember.
And I think that's because... You're the wrong person for that
joke. I was about to say, you're not the same person you were. Yeah. Like, I put out my first CD in 99, and I listened, but it's like a time capsule of the person I was then, not just how I'm telling the jokes, but the jokes that I'm telling.
I can't even listen to my old shit. I can't believe you can listen.
I don't do it very often.
No, I mean, even if you said to me, sit down and listen to your, like, my first CD was probably, like, around then, 98, 99, and if you said, sit down and listen to it, I'm like, I can't. I can't do it. It'll just make me angry and upset.
Yeah, that's same here. Like watching, I can't watch videos of myself, especially
neither.
Earlier stuff.
Oh, I can't watch shit from yesterday. You know, when I have to, like, I'm working on this new hour, and I'm listening to all my sets every night, and it's so depressing. I'm like, oh God, they were laughing so much less than I thought they were. So this joke didn't work, and this joke didn't work, and this joke didn't work.
Yeah, but I think it's the nature of the beast. It's what we have to, I mean, to grow, we have to hear what we're doing.
Starting a whole new hour is the most painful thing in the world.
It's frustrating. Like, when I try to do a new hour, I take new ideas that I have and kind of put them into bits that I know these will work, and just, I slowly kind of pick and choose and dissect my first hour and just kind of morphs into my second hour.
I used to do that, and I did that all the time. But the problem, what happened with me was jokes started getting old jokes just started getting better and longer rather than new jokes.
It's kind of forming.
Yeah, like these would get added. The new line would get added to an old joke. And so now I see why Louis and Carlin and these guys did what they did with Seinfeld, mm-hmm. retiring a whole act and starting from scratch, because that way it's all new and you're not morphing things.
Yeah, it's true.
But it's terrible because you're like, oh, this is so good, and it would fit with this so well. But I go to Australia and I have to have a new hour every year. So,
wow.
So it's a painful process. I mean, my January and February, I leave February 12th. My January and February, because the first 2 weeks of Australia, I'm really working the hour out, are the most painful months of my life. Like, they are just brutal.
So are you writing an hour over this and next month?
Well, I work on the hour all year, but I really have to put it to paper, rehearse it, get it together, and perform it on February 12th.
Wow.
And the critics come out about February 15th, 16th to see. I get a couple shows that they call, I forget what they call them, workshops or something, and where the media is not allowed to come to the show and the audience knows it's like a work in progress. So I get a couple nights where people, and I think they discount the ticket,
mm-hmm.
and people come out going, hey, but it's not much different 3 days later.
Right.
Then the critics come to see me. The critics watch the show, and then they write about it. Oof. So if I do old bits, they always not to me, but I've seen them write to many people, and they'll say, show is good if you like his old stuff.
Huh.
So you have that fear of the critics seeing you before. They will know your bits. And, you know, I have fans all the time. When I'll do a whole new act and maybe throw in two or three old lines. And they'll go, oh, yeah, I've heard you do that diarrhea joke before. And you're like, that was in a heckle I had to deal with. You know, so knowing that people are that aware.
It's a lot of pressure.
So much pressure. And then I feel like I'm putting up subpar material because of that pressure.
See, maybe it's me. I don't know. I always had this kind of idea that, like, when I go to a club, you know, the second time, like a year later, I'll usually have about 20 minutes of new material, but I always think people like coming to hear bits that they know.
I agree.
Like, it's like going to see a band and not hearing the
right.
classics.
And I also think people, I mean, a comedy nerd maybe wants to hear a whole new hour.
Comedy snob.
Like if I was going to see one of my favorites, I would want to see all the new stuff. But people bring people to see.
Exactly. Specifically
to see. Exactly.
Right. And I think that a lot. Like, people bring their friends going, you got to see this guy. And you want them, you want to share the stuff you enjoy with them.
Right.
So you're like, here's, I want you to hear this bit he does about this. I want you to hear this bit he does about this. So, I mean, I've heard Gabriel Iglesias does, I just worked with him in India. And he does a thing where he does his whole new act. And then at the end, he goes, all right, now I'll take requests.
Oh, yeah.
And he does bits from the past.
From the past.
Which is a good way of doing it.
That's a really smart way of doing it. Yeah. That's very cool. Well, you know what? Speaking of doing it, is that good, huh?
That's a good segue. All right,
good. Speaking of doing it, Eddie, this is a little part of the show called The Skippy Green Show.
It's The Skippy Green Show.
I'm a massive Skippy Green fan.
As well you should be, Eddie F.
Did you know I met this guy as Skippy? Well, I met Skippy
Green. We're not talking to you. You're muted. Eddie. How you doing? Turn your back. If I could turn you back on, trust me, you wouldn't be walking. All right, Eddie.
Hey, Skippy, how are you?
Good. It's been a while. I haven't seen you since I was at your place doing the podcast with you and that Australian fruit that you used to talk to.
Yeah.
But, this little part of the show, Eddie, here's how it's going to work. I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
And you got to answer the question in 10 words exactly.
Oh, God.
Not 11, not 9, 10 words. She will be your fingers. You could watch her, see where you are. Are you ready, my friend?
I am ready.
Here we go. If you could fuck any brand of alcohol, what brand would it be and why? 10 seconds.
10 seconds, too?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Ten words. I'd fuck tequila because there's a chance I'd get worm cock.
Perfect.
It's the Skippy Green Show.
I wanted to say worm up the cock, but I lost.
You ran out of words.
Yeah.
You actually hyphenated it in my mind, so yeah. It was worm cock.
Judge's ruling works on that.
Yes.
Dude, thanks so much for coming by and
thanks
doing
for
this.
Having
it was really
fun.
It was really
very,
cool hanging
very
with
cathartic.
You. Yay, that's what glad lunch for dinner to help. Is.
That's
I'm trying to figure it all out right now. I'm trying to get my point of view and figure out, you know.
What's well, it honestly sounds like you've had a hell of a journey, but you're to a very good place with you right now.
Man. Yeah, sort of. No,
well, what do you,
I'm a
any,
fucking comic.
Any...
Did you see that article recently that came out about comics being crazy?
No.
It's they did like a massive study in the UK and found that like most comedians suffer from like we're very similar to like sociopaths. And the amount of depression and bipolar disorder and all kinds of stuff that it runs rampant in the comedy community. And
wow.
Something about the reason we feel the need to make people laugh is to soothe or is to, you know, get our endorphins going. There was a big article about it, which a lot of it was common sense, but a lot of it was like, wow, it is kind of scary how – and I've had this argument with people before. Do you think people were naturally crazy and it drew them to comedy? Or do you think comedy made them crazy?
Interesting. It's like
maybe
what came first?
Maybe a little from column A, a little from column B.
Because I think comedy has made me a bit crazy.
Yeah, I would agree with that for me too.
Because I was a very, very happy kid and very like life was good. And I think, you know... They say an active mind can never be a depressed mind. We're fortunate enough in a way and unfortunate in another way that we have a lot of time to think.
Yes.
And you start to dwell and you, whereas other people just go, mm-hmm. You know, we make fun of them, you know, like those guys that wake up at fucking 7 a.m. and get in their car and go to work and get in their cubicle and work all day long and they're exhausted. They come home, they kiss their wife, they eat their dinner, and they go to bed because they got to get up and do it all over again. Those guys don't have time to think about, am I where I need
to
be
exactly?
To be
in my life right now. Yeah.
We do it all fucking day long.
We have so much time to ponder.
Very active mind.
Yeah.
We're the lucky ones.
Any plugs or anything?
I'm at Morty's Joke Joint next week in
Indianapolis.
Nice,
in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
Tell Hofstetter I said hi.
I will. There, Morty's. And then the weekend after, I'm at the Madhouse Comedy Club in San Diego.
Well, just remember that this is going up on the 28th of January.
28th of January, right. So that weekend, I'm at Morty's Joke Joint. The next weekend, okay. I'm at the... Madhouse Comedy Club in San Diego, and then the weekend or following that, I'll be in Australia doing the Adelaide Fringe Festival.
Fantastic!
And you can find me at Eddie Ift, and my podcast is called Talking Shit.
The Talking Shit podcast.
But I think you got to look. It's so hard for people to find because we're not allowed to say shit on iTunes, so it's Talkin's Hit. But if you go to
Talking Shit.
If you go to my website eddieift.com, you can find it.
And that's IFFT.
Yes,
that's excellent.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
And Allie?
And, of course, at Allison Comedy or AllisonComedy.com.
Excellent. And
it's the 28th, and you can see possibly – wait, what's coming up then? You can see Flip and I in El Paso.
Well, we're going to be in Claremont this Thursday at Flappers.
Not if something else happens.
Well, possibly. At this point, we don't know, but when this goes
okay,
up –
okay, whatever. Possibly Claremont. Check our websites. You'll
exactly.
Know what's up. Blah, blah, blah.
And yeah, that's right. And don't forget, guys, I will be going to Sweden. Anybody in Stockholm and Gothenburg, I'll be performing around there between the 15th and 22nd of February. And Allison and I will be at the El Paso Comedy Club, excuse me, Comic Strip, March 5th
through the 9th. And again, right around this time, my episode of that sitcom I did, Instant Mom, should be airing sometime on Nick at Night. If I don't know when it is right now, so go to the website because I'm sure there'll be more updates there. FlipIsFunny.com at Flip Schultz on Twitter. Eddie, again, man, thanks so much for
thanks
doing
for
this.
Having me, guys.
It really was great having you, and we'll see you guys next time.
What's for dinner? What's
Bye.
For dinner? What's for dinner?
Sweden.
Talking about what's ever on their
when
minds.
When did you book the Sweden?
Talking about what's ever on their minds.